Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Hope that you're having a good day. Welcome to this session of the Mormon History Association. The session this afternoon is titled Artifact in Mormon History, a Cross-Cultural Examination. And we're going to hear from four excellent presenters. They will speak in the order that they show up in your program. And then we will hear some comments from Alan Morrell at the end. First of all, my name is Tiffany Bowles. I'm an educator at the Church History Museum here in Salt Lake. And so I have the pleasure of highlighting each of the presenters today. And our first presenter is Elise Boxer. She is an enrolled citizen of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes. She is Dakota from the Sisseton and Wahpeton bands. She received her PhD in history from Arizona State University, and she is a professor of history and coordinator of Native American Studies at the University of South Dakota. Her presentation today is Indigenous Cradleboards as Material, Culture, and History. Elise.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to acknowledge my Indigenous relatives whose land we're guests on today. And so this is a paper, this is kind of what I'm thinking my next project may be, my next book, but I'm looking at ways in which to tell a story by weaving together my own family history into larger community history using a framework of Mormon and American settler colonialism. My interest really comes from growing up in Poplar, Montana, which is located on the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux Reservation in northeastern Montana. I want to be clear first that I'm presenting, what I'm presenting today really comes from my own experiences. It's not meant to represent my entire community or all Dakota people for that matter. We are part of what we would call a diaspora, where we are spread across various different states and countries as a result of the U.S. Dakota War of 1862. What I want to do is to show the complexity of what it means to be Dakota within a Mormon context. This paper will specifically focus on Dakota cradleboards to better understand how Dakota cradleboards can be used not just as a historical artifact, but a medium in which oral histories and community history can be woven together. In the Dakota context, cradleboards changed over a period of time after contact with non-Dakotas and the introduction of various textiles and beads. How did Dakota women indigenize and incorporate these foreign textiles and beads into these cradleboards? Why did the use of cradleboards slowly disappear in the late 20th century? And why are cradleboards currently being reclaimed, used, and revitalized as an integral part of Dakota child-rearing practices within our communities? Finally, this paper will juxtapose Dakota cradleboards and oral histories against a historical written record of how Mormons viewed indigenous peoples, and specifically indigenous women and children in the 19th, 20th century. Is the Mormon historical narrative of indigenous, or in this context, Dakota women and children, accurate? Or does it continue to perpetuate stereotypes of indigenous women and children? Finally, this paper seeks to utilize and contribute to indigenous methodology by using material culture and oral histories to better understand the interconnectedness of indigenous culture, child-rearing practices, and gender. Recent publications in Mormon history have attempted to bring together two marginalized, often siloed fields of history, Mormon indigenous history, together. For example, recent publications in the last several years have not only offered up intersectional methodologies and established new theoretical frameworks that indigenize Mormon history. These publications, for example, Essays on American Indian and Mormon History, Decolonizing Mormonism, Approaching a Post-Colonial Zion, and a special issue on race in the Journal of Mormon History, to name just a few, challenge Mormon scholars to, quote, disrupt those racial narratives that position 19th century Mormonism as a triumphant and uncomplicated foray into known, unknown geographies where the strange, the exotic, and the challenging were experienced with simple grace and faith, end quote. These monographs and articles have not only complicated Mormon history, but have contributed to a shared history by using, quote, decolonizing methodologies and critical race theories that privilege the previously othered voice, end quote. Indigenous epistemologies and methodologies change the ways in which Mormon history can and should be written. Rather than being objects of the Mormon colonial gaze or actors that appear only as they intersect with white Mormon history, Indigenous voices and perspectives must inform one's theory and methodology. Gina Colvin, a Maori scholar, articulated in her introduction, Theorizing Mormon Race Scholarship in the July 2015 Journal of Mormon History issue, the ongoing colonization of Indigenous people vis-a-vis the Mormon archive that shapes methodology and ultimately one's perspective of history. Colvin asserts that Mormons are a people of, quote, books, newspapers, letters, diaries, ledgers, and membership records. These are the physical signs of these constructed racialized subjects, which can be found in the millions of linear feet of published and unpublished texts produced by the Mormons' unrivaled missionary work, then carefully deposited into church archives. However, these transcripts of religious colonization, while useful in constructing a certain historical account, also need to be understood as arising out of a broader social and political context that framed and structured the Christian evangelicizing work in non-white spaces generally. End quote. If Mormon scholars do not exclusively rely on the Mormon archive or written record, what sources are available? If a scholar is interested in Indigenous people's history, scholars must go to the communities in which they are interested in researching. Scholars must become familiar with the language, culture, and community so that research can be done in a truly collaborative manner and grounded in an Indigenous perspective. For example, Dakota historian Waziatawin utilized and centered the Dakota language and oral histories and tradition in her monograph, which is groundbreaking. Although Waziatawin is Dakota and returned to work in her own community and with elders, it was the community that ultimately directed her research. In her book, Remember This, Dakota Decolonization and the Eli Taylor Narratives, Waziatawin skillfully articulates the importance of using Dakota language and oral histories traditions as an important research methodological tool when writing about Dakota history, language, and identity. In doing so, the way in which Dakota history is written changes. For example, the Dakota language always appears first, never italicized and placed into brackets or parentheses. Instead, it is English that is placed into parentheses and or appears second for translation purposes only. And just to give you an example of this, I have two books. The one on the right is the one I just referenced, Waziatawin's work. And that one, as you can see in bold, and first again without being italicized, is the Dakota language. And she worked with an elder to do those. And then also providing English translations. And again, the reason for that is so that those Dakotas who are not first language speakers can learn the language and as it is from a first language speaker. And so in this book, she works with Eli Taylor, an elder from Canada, but he basically talks through these different stories. And again, as this book was published like in 2005, and at the time, excuse me, 2012, it should not have been groundbreaking, but it continues to be groundbreaking. You don't really see this at all. The other book to the left is something that I was interested in, kind of piqued my interest. And so a book I've assigned for some of my courses is Dakota Women's Work, Creativity, Culture, and Exile by Colette Hyman. Now with this, and again, even though she had went into a community, she worked both in Lake Sisseton and then also the Flandre Indian Reservation. There are problems with this particular book. And part of it is because if you're only focusing on one or two individuals within communities, you get, you know, that particular perspective. So I won't go into too many details, but what's important and significant about this is looking at various things that Dakota women made as a way to tell history. So whether we're talking about like moccasins, whether we're talking about cradle boards, whether we're talking about like any beaded or quilled worked items, it tells a history and a story. So this is kind of where I go ahead and I'm going to go ahead and get started, hopefully. So this is actually a photo that was taken July 2nd, 2017 in the foyer of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Chapel in Poplar, Montana, which is located again on my reservation. This is my second son, so you'll probably see my sister wandering around with my son right now, my third son. But my second son in this photograph is Tatanka Wakian. And we are visiting our homelands for the first time since his birth 2 weeks before this photo was taken. While this photo may seem like another posed photograph of a baby in a cradle board, it is so much more. What is missing from this photograph is the rich history that is manifested in the traditional Bida Dakota cradle board and the foyer of the LDS branch, which serves as a backdrop of this photo. And those chairs were there when I was growing up, so they've been there for a very long time. This photo, again, is about the rich history of the Dakota and Assiniboine people and family that has called Poplar, Montana home for many generations. This photo is the physical documentation of two generations of the Boxer family, and while it may not be obvious, we can learn about the lives of Dakota people whose lives intersect with Mormonism in this photo. So in this photo, we can gather the immediate quote-unquote facts, right? So we can document the two individuals, myself and my son, and this really is his full name, Tatanka Joaquin Alejandro Valdez Boxer. So beyond these names, what do we know about these two individuals? So according to the written record, a.k.a. Facebook, we know just their names. However, there's so much more. In their names, there's an important family genealogy, oral tradition, language, and culture that can be collected and documented. For example, my name, Elise, is actually the name of my paternal great-grandmother's. My parents named me after her, and it is her name that I have carried in honor and respect. Now, my son's name, while a mouthful, is much more than it's a fusion of two cultures, Dakota and Mexican. So Tatanka Joaquin is my great-great-grandfather's name and can be translated into English as Thunderbolt. My son's middle name, Alejandro, is his paternal grandfather's name. Alejandro is my husband's stepfather, and we named our son to honor not only his Mexican heritage, but a man who has played a pivotal role in my husband's life. And my son's last name, Valdez Boxer, and again, from the English tradition, you actually see that inverted and typically hyphenated, but we follow the Mexican tradition in which children take both the names of the last names of their parents, and the father's name being listed first. So I explained this to my husband. I kind of count it as a win, which is why I say there's two Boxer generations in this photo. So again, these names reflect the importance of Dakota kinship. Colette Hyman's Dakota Women's Work, Creativity, Culture, and Exile highlights the importance of naming. And I quote, "For the Dakota and other indigenous peoples, person names reflected and reinforced core values, beliefs, and cultural identity and social organization. In naming their children, parents situated them within their families, giving newborns names that identify them by gender and order of their birth. The firstborn daughter received the name Winona, for instance, and the firstborn son typically was named Chaske. The conferring of a special names later in life became celebratory occasions at which a new name, which identified a unique gift, personality trait, or accomplishment, or memorialized an ancestor, was proclaimed before the community as a whole. These ceremonies confirm the special place of the individual among his or her people." End quote. So Dakota naming is significant because it reflects Dakota kinship and place in Poplar. My son's name carries and honors his great-great-great-grandfather, and it ties him both literally and spiritually to his Dakota Teopshpi, or family. Ella Deloria, Dakota anthropologist, articulated that, quote, "The ultimate aim of Dakota life, stripped of accessories, was quite simple. One must obey kinship rules. One must be a good relative," end quote. My son's name represents his responsibility to his people to live as a good Dakota. His name identifies as Dakota and connects him to specific families in Poplar. And again, this photo illustrates kinship and relationality. Finally, the LDS built chapel building serves as a physical site that reflects Teopshpi, and it connects Dakota and Assiniboine families whose relationship to one another cannot be defined or categorized as member or non-member, active or inactive. And instead, this LDS church has become the center of our community. So part of eventually my next project, I'll look at this and talk about different oral histories of where a lot of people, whether members or not, actually use like the gymnasium, for example, for like basketball or, you know, different like women getting together, doing like star quilts, for example. So when I returned home in the summer of 2017, I was excited to take my sons to the church that I attended growing up. As a young child, I remember the church and the culture hall seemed enormous. And today, the building and cultural hall appear much smaller than my memory, but continues to remain significant. This photo, again, that I had showed you, was taken in celebration of our return with our second son. And we eventually took other photos, but part of what's missing again from this history is that this chapel was not under construction until 1966, in which they actually, according to one of our members, he states that Elder Broadbent and I and other elders worked on getting approval from the tribal council to lease land. And it wasn't until then that they began construction. Now, the LDS Church did arrive again in Fort Peck much earlier, but it arrived on the west end of our reservation in largely Kerfordid and Assiniboines in like the early 1910s. They didn't make their way, and they were actually banned from our reservation. So yeah, they didn't come back until like the 1960s, and that's actually when my grandparents converted. And I think I'm running out of time, right? Yeah. I got my timer up here. I'm not going to be one of those people. So I'm just going to I'm going to talk really quickly and just kind of highlight a few points. So part of this, these are my grandparents. This is my father's dad. And actually my dad looks almost just like this. And his name is Tony Boxer. And this is my grandmother, Maddie Ina Ricker. They're among some of the first converts, Dakota converts. And they weren't baptized in this chapel because it wasn't yet built. They were actually baptized just off the reservation in Glasgow. So the other thing I'm just going to kind of conclude with is in my last few minutes is just to give you an idea of some of the cradle boards and why it's significant, because one of the things that my sister had done is one, our sisters, for Dakota sisters, are really responsible for doing our taking care of our children. So traditionally in our language, we call our aunts, like my sisters would be called Ina, which is mother. The same thing that my children would call me. And again, if it was my father or my husband's sister, they would actually call her Tumi, which means aunt. But it signifies, it specifically references the paternal, you know, father's sister. Now, language, because it's changed over time, you see that conflated, and everybody calls auntie, like aunties, like Tumi, even though my sister should be called Ina, like a mother, sister. So I actually brought the cradle board, one of my cradle boards. Now this is the one my sister did, and it actually typically has a board on the back of it, the one that you can see like in the photo. Part of it you'll see is like there's seven main designs, and one of the things that my sister had said when I was asking questions of her was like, well, did you pick seven deliberately? Because for us, seven is significant as Dakota people. And she's like, no, it just happened. And I was like, it didn't just happen. And so, and there's different things as you can kind of see this. And part of it, there's one design in here. I was like, this is facing the wrong way. And she's like, how do you know it was not meant to be that way? And it's a reminder again for us as Dakota people that not everything is perfect, and that as you bead in like basically the prayers to the children with that. So I'll just go ahead and conclude because I don't want to take any additional time. And if you have questions, I'll answer them later. Thank you.
Thank you, Elise. That was excellent. Our next presenter is Ian Barber, who is a former Fulbright Scholar and Associate Professor at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He was the 2018-2019 Marlon K. Jensen Scholar in Residence for the Tanner Humanities Center, teaching a special topics course titled Mormons and the Past and delivering numerous lectures. His presentation today is A Strange and Interesting Document, The Latter-day Saint Shaping of a Prophetic Maori Covenant.
Okay, so I'm really sorry, folks. I should have printed this out, but I haven't been able to find a printer this morning. So, and I'm going to stick to a text. If any of you have heard me talk before, I tend to not do the text thing, but given that time is so tight and that I do occasionally wander a little, I think text is the way to go here. Okay, so we'll just begin with my thanking the Tanner Centre, in particular at the University of Utah, where I've been since August of last year, other than a short break back in New Zealand at the beginning of this year, because I had some teaching obligations I couldn't get out of, but I'm back till the end of this month, and it's just been a fantastic opportunity. Really have appreciated that I've held the Marlon Jensen Fellowship, and so I'm just very grateful to the award committee and to the Tanner Centre for facilitating that research. And the research I'm presenting on today, although it's based on work in part in New Zealand, was really facilitated in some important ways by research while I was here. And in fact, there's two documents that I'll talk about. One in particular, the primary document I basically located in arriving here, and another one that fortuitously is in the serendipity of research that I picked up just in research a couple of weeks ago that will be useful. Okay, so let's just quickly put you all in the picture. So we're talking about New Zealand, that's the European name, the Māori name being used increasingly is Aotearoa, land of the long white cloud. New Zealand is in the southwest Pacific. That kind of pink area is eastern Polynesia. The localities of Samoa, Tonga, just right to the west of the Cook Islands, represent western Polynesia, where, of course, there are very substantial Latter-day Saint indigenous Samoan and Tongan populations. But I'm discussing New Zealand. There we go. Look, that shows you Western Polynesia and Eastern Polynesia. I forgot that I did that. So here is Aotearoa. New Zealand is in Polynesia, but it is not tropical. In the very far north, it's arguably subtropical to warm, but most of the country is temperate climate, very seasonal. Christianity has been preached in New Zealand to indigenous Māori since the beginning of the 19th century. That's Samuel Marsden, the first CMS missionary, preaching in 1814. Okay, so in 1950, the North American periodical of what in Māori is Te Hahi o Ihu Karaiti o Ngā Hunga Tapu o Ngā Rā, or Murine, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, published an article that reported the discovery of a photograph of a 19th century indigenous Māori covenant. The article was written by Matthew Cowley, a member of the church's highest governing quorum of apostles. Apostle Cowley had been a former missionary and thereafter a mission president in New Zealand during World War II. Cowley reported that he was present in New Zealand when the photograph of this covenant was discovered. The apostle titled his article, "Māori Chief Predicts Coming of LDS Missionaries," and he referred to the events, he referred to the events of a tribal meeting held at an important Māori meeting house called Ngā Tau E Waru, which is literally the 8 years. He named the house Ngā Tau E Waru because a rival seer had said that he would never build the house within 8 years. He built it within 3 years. So as a matter of derision, he titled it the 8 years. In a marae or a complex at a place called Te Oriori, which is situated in the lower North Island region of Wairarapa, which is the tribal region of Ngāti Kahununu and Rangitane. Now, at this meeting, a learned sage, according to Cowley, Paura Te Potangaroa, was reportedly asked, which of the churches is the church for the Māori? In Cowley's narrative, Te Potangaroa responded, "My friends, the church for the Māori has not yet come among us. You will recognize it when it does." And in Cowley's narrative, Te Potangaroa outlined several signs of the coming of the church, how the missionaries would be recognized. Now, after saying these things, Cowley added, as a partial answer to the question, he called a scribe to write what he would dictate. The translation of what was written was a covenant for remembering the hidden words which were revealed by the Spirit of Jehovah. Now, this document was recovered in the course of a New Zealand church conference that President Cowley attended. He was the mission president, as I said, during the Second World War. At this conference, a Latter-day Saint Māori, who was also one of the few Māori high priests in New Zealand, Eriata Nopira, had told a meeting of the council that he'd been present at this meeting in 1881 when Potangaroa spoke, and he'd heard the prophecy about the coming of the true church to the Māori people. And at the close of the meeting, a Māori sister, according to Kali, came up to Nopira and said, "Actually, I've got a copy of that document. She asked her husband to go back to the home to find an item which Cowley said was rolled in brown paper at the bottom of her trunk. A package was duly received, unrolled, and this revealed a photograph of the covenant that had been taken before the original was sealed up. That's Ngā Tau e Waru, where Te Pō Tangaroa spoke, and oops, where's the covenant? There it is. And there it is. Cowley confirmed that the photograph had been concealed from public view as a sacred document until its presentation to Nōpera. And in 1950, he observed it is now in possession of the writer. In reporting this covenant, Cowley noted that Pō Tangaroa was only one of several native prophets who foretold the coming of the LDS missionaries to the Māori people. Indeed, the Latter-day Saint Church Press had already covered one of these in the beginning of the 19th century. An account was told from a Māori by the name of Hereni Whanga, who migrated to Salt Lake City, of a seer called Te Toiroa, who had predicted the arrival of one who would come from across the ocean, who would pray with upraised hands and bring the true karakia, or prayer for the Māori. When Latter-day Saints visited Te Toiroa's old home and prayed with upraised hands in 1884, they were recognised by local Māori as fulfilling Toiroa's prophecy. However, Cowley's mid-20th century discovery delivered something novel by way of these Māori Advent prophets. He delivered now material evidence of a prophetic expression composed months before the first multiple Māori conversions to the Latter-day Saints. There were a handful of variant text copies of the covenant in circulation. Cowley's discovery was unique, however, in identifying an original. This novelty was not lost on former New Zealand missionaries William Cole and Alwyn Jensen, who had themselves photographed at Ngā Tau e Waru. Let's just see where that is coming up here. There they are. Who published a genealogical text in 1960 on Polynesian genealogicals, and they referred to Pō Tangaroa's prophecy as one of the better documented of these ancient native predictions, and recognised that the covenant had been written so that the people would always remember these predictions. Following Cowley, they described and referred to an illustration at the top of the covenant, which appeared to show a drawing of the rising sun, which they and Cowley suggested symbolised the direction, the east, from which the true church would come. They also pointed to an all-seeing eye illustrated in the covenant, and Cole and Jensen give the name of the described this as a strange and interesting document, a description that I've used to name this paper. Now, Cowley's narrative has been cited in reviews of Māori Advent prophets by Latter-day Saint historians and by Latter-day Saint Māori as well ever since. The original copy remained in the Cowley family, so there were just sort of murky photocopies that were in circulation, but in 2013, the copy that you see here was given to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Church History Library. That's the item that I discovered arriving here in August of last year, I've been the translation such the translation that I'm referring to when I am referring to bits and pieces that'll have to wrap up very quickly come from my reading of that text. And access to this original, and that's the material link, that's the material culture link in terms of the theme of this this session. And this now provides a new opportunity to look both at what Te Pō Tangaroa said and Cowley's interpretation. Now, what I'm going to do is just quickly refer to the original context. So Te Pō Tangaroa, as a Māori prophet of the late 19th century, is one of a number of late 19th century prophet figures who emerged among Māori to preach a message of divine deliverance from the effects of post-1840 British colonisation of New Zealand. The loss of Māori land was a particular concern, and a non-Latter-day Saint accounts of this meeting emphasised Te Potongaroa's concern over land fragmentation and the need for Māori to unite against ongoing land dispossession. Now, Cowley was not oblivious to these politics. He said that the convention had been called for the purpose of discussing political, social and religious problems, but he would follow the lead of earlier New Zealand mission publications and emphasise the religious dimensions of Te Potongaroa's prophecy. I'm going to just pick up two of those. As he translated it, Cowley referred to an unusual derived noun set out in a list of predictive themes for 3 years. So year 1881 was the day of the fullness. The year 1882 was a year that Potongaroa used a Māori word kōpinga to describe. Now, Matthew Cowley interpreted kōpinga, and this is another document that I've just found recently, which gives insight into Matthew Cowley going to bed one Sunday night and thinking about Kawenata Whakamaharatanga, the memorial covenant of Potongaroa, shortly after it had been found. He, as I did, I might add, when I was working on this, was really trying to nut out this word kōpinga, which is a very unusual Māori word. It's a derived noun, and it's not generally found in contemporary speech. And as Cowley says here, and I'll just read just very quickly, on Sunday night when I went to bed, I couldn't get out of my mind the words ko te rā o te kōpinga. During the night, I awoke like a flash and it came to me what it meant. It means the day of hinging together. Kopi, the verb, is to hinge, to bring together something that's hinged or connected. And Cowley saw this as the word sealing. That is the literal translation. In other words, it means the day of sealing. Now, Cowley also perceived a prophetic reference to the Salt Lake Temple, the Salt Lake City Temple, in a clause he translated as the sacred church with a large wall surrounding. These words are descriptive of Temple Square in Salt Lake City, and President Cowley also pointed out that the drawing of the all-seeing eye is significant in this respect. So for Cowley, the temple theme was reiterated in the conclusion that all that was written would be fulfilled by the Ngāti Kahununu tribe of Potongaroa within the next 40 years. And Cowley observed that it was that tribe who were representatives of that tribe only who received temple ordinances during that 20 years, not until 2 minutes, okay. It wasn't until after 1921 that Māori of other tribes began coming to the temple. In short, Cowley interpreted this document as a prediction of temple blessings, temple architecture, and temple ordinances coming to and being practiced by Māori. And that has remained a very influential perspective. Now, so I've only got a couple of minutes left, so we're just going to flick through to the latter part of the paper. As with the Latter-day Saints who had synthesized Old and New Testament themes of gathered Israel temples and Christian deliverance, Te Potongaroa wove selected Christian themes into Kawenata and the future of his own people. And interestingly, when we look at how it was received at the time, here is the account of a Latter-day Saint missionary, Elmer Greenwood, who came to the Wairarapa in 1883. He wrote in his diary that the Māoris had all turned against the Church of England. Some 3 years ago, a native said that an angel came to him and told him in 82 or 83, all the religions among the Māoris would be done away with and a new religion would come, but did not know where they came from. He added, some think that the religion we preach is the new one which was to come. Now, Greenwood's account, interestingly, picks up the broad sweep of the covenant in the early 1880s, and this is consistent with a translation of this notion of kōpinga as a bringing together, a gathering of scattered peoples. And in fact, the covenant itself makes reference to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And this apocalyptic tone is reinforced in a number of other accounts from Māori that I don't have time to go into.
the bottom line is, in the context of the 1880s, the covenant was an apocalyptic document that basically said to Māori, all other churches will be done away with, a true one is coming for you, and that's the context in which Māori accepted the church in huge numbers in the 1880s in New Zealand, especially and firstly among Ngāti Kahununu, it was most definitely a much different context and concept, i.e. prophetic deliverance. The interpretation of President Cowley in the 1950s related to a very different church and a very different context in a devotional theme and an emphasis on temples. Okay, so I'm just about done. I'll just finish here and note, just in conclusion, the challenge here is to differentiate both contexts, 1880s and 1950s, so as to do justice to the understanding and concerns of each place and time. For example, to insist that Cowley was wrong to interpret Te Potangaroa's document in terms of temple, ritual and architecture would be unhelpful and miss the point, I suggest. Cowley's shaping of Te Kawenata in 1950 served the interests of the church, certainly, but also reinforced the faith of Māori Latter-day Saints, who have cited Cowley's account as a narrative of faith and pride, cultural pride. In effect, God using Māori prophets and concepts as a vehicle to establish the gospel. And yet the politics of Te Kawenata are as relevant as ever in contemporary New Zealand. Since 1984, the New Zealand government has responded positively to recommendations for redress of treaty breaches, including land confiscation. And Ngāti Kahununu are one of those iwi who are still claiming against the Crown. So in terms of reception history, it is not implausible. The Latter-day Saints among Ngāti Kahununu, and there are many of them, as well as other iwi, may well yet seek to explore the earlier political dimensions of Te Kawenata in New Zealand beyond Cowley's still dominant temple interpretation. Thank you.
Right. Our next presenter is Barbara Jones Brown. She is the Executive Director of the Mormon History Association. She earned a graduate degree in American History from the University of Utah and worked as the content editor for the book Massacre at Mountain Meadows, Volume 1. She's the co-author of Volume 2 of that series with Richard E. Turley, Jr. And she was recently the historical director for Better Days 2020, a nonprofit organization that promotes women's history in Utah. Her presentation today is A Stitch in Time, Using Artifact to Uncover Hidden Women's History. Barbara.
Recently, my husband and I hosted a dinner party at our house. This is about a year ago, and we were playing cards with friends after dinner, and one of my friends turned to me and she said, Barbara, you're into Mormon history. I have this cross stitch that was my mom's, and she found it folded up in her trunk, and she found it, and it was in pretty good shape, so she took it and framed it, and it hung on her wall for decades. And my mom recently passed away, so my sister now has it hanging on her living room wall. And she says, will you take a look at it and see if it's anything? And I was just playing cards, so wasn't thinking much about it. And I said, sure, have your sister take a picture of it and text it back to us. So she said, okay, so I'm playing cards. And then she goes, oh, here it is. And my jaw dropped. This is the cross stitch that was hanging on her sister's wall. Now, the reason why my jaw dropped when I saw this was Laurel Ulrich was recently, before that, giving a lecture at the Tanner Humanities Center. And before as part of the a tour she was doing in the church history library, she had a cross stitch that looked very similar to this, and she had shown it to me. And she also had it in her book. So this is a page from Laurel's book that I had seen this before. So I said, going back to this, I said, I think I know what that is. So I ran upstairs and I grabbed a house full of females, ran back downstairs, and we found this page and I showed it to my friend and we could not believe it. So we compared it, and we were pretty certain that it was done by the same person. This is a cross stitch made by Anne Eckford. She was a British convert to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the mid-19th century. And it was a cross stitch based on a plate that was created and produced in England about that time. And so apparently this young woman who had created this cross stitch, she was a teenager at the time, named Anne Eckford, had taken this plate in England and had used it to create her embroidery. So if you look around the edges of the embroidery, you can see the names of the apostles of the church during the Nauvoo period. This is the Nauvoo Temple, of course, in the center. And it has the initials after each of these names around the cross stitch. And they're similar to the initials that appear in the Kirtland Temple and that later appeared in the Nauvoo Temple. So she clearly, being a teenage convert in England, did not know what those initials meant, but she was using this plate as her guide to include that information. So Laurel's book, we read, identified that there were three of these cross stitches known to be in existence. So you'll see the one on the far left here is the one that appeared in Ulrich's book. You'll see that this is the one that I found that identified hanging on my friend's wall, and that these two others were the other two known to be in existence. This one down here was made by Anne's little sister in England. And this one hung on the wall of the Beehive House for many years, just kind of as an old cross stitch, until somebody identified what it was, and it was immediately taken down and placed into safekeeping of the archives. So you can see how they're all based on that twigs plate. I wanted to point out that the angel in each of these cross stitches is the recumbent angel. This is a reproduction of it that appears on the top of the Nauvoo Temple weather vane. So I received permission from my friend to remove the cross stitch from its frame. It had just been no kind of special museum glass or anything like that to protect it. So I identified an expert using the help of Alan Morell here. He helped me identify an expert who has written about cross stitches or historic embroidery. And we together very carefully removed this from its frame and examined the back of it. So on the left is the back of, so it reflects the colors that were originally used in this silk thread. And you can see how over the many, many years it has faded to be the color that it is today. But there's the original bright colors that were used. The embroidery expert told me that Anne was a pretty good embroiderer, that this reflects high skill, but also that she was apparently a teenager and she was developing her skills. And so each different embroidery kind of reflects a progression in her skills. There's the back side of it, so you can have a closer look. Now, what's interesting about this is some might call this a sampler, but it's not a sampler. I looked into what those were in order to try and understand this artifact. Samplers were typically things that young girls used to learn how to create alphabets and how to improve their skills. And so they usually made one sampler that they would use throughout their lives. And again, it was typically an alphabet with a saying at the bottom, and they would use that as a pattern to continue throughout their lives. And typically, they would only make one sampler. But Anne, for some reason, made several of these. And actually, when I was talking with Laurel Ulrich about this, about after finding this fourth one, she said, I always thought there might be more, because apparently she was producing many of these. Now, why would she do that? If you look closely at the bottom here, she says that she, Anne Eckford, made it for William Glover. So my friend and I wondered, who was William Glover? And she said, I think that might be my ancestor. So we did some genealogy and confirmed that William Glover was my friend's great-great-great-grandfather. So good provenance there. We researched William Glover, and sure enough, he served a mission in England when Anne was a teenager and when this plate was produced. Now, if you look at the one here, I forgot my glasses. This one was for S.W. Richards, correct? Okay. So I researched, who is S.W. Richards? S.W. Richards was Samuel W. Richards. He was a mission president in England when William Glover was serving there as a missionary, and Anne's family, the Eckfords, had recently joined the church. Perhaps Anne had made this for Samuel W. Richards, and perhaps he had it displayed on his wall in the mission home. And when William Glover, my friend's ancestor, was a missionary there, saw it, perhaps he asked her to make one for him as well. And this tradition continued, and she continued to make these and sell them. Okay, now I want to tell you about a different woman named Zinah Young Card. Zinah Young Card is one of the most famous women in Mormon history. She was the daughter of Brigham Young and Zinah Diantha Huntington Young. She was the couple's only child, and she grew up in the newly constructed Lion House in Salt Lake City. She was quite close to her siblings, including a half-sibling named Sousa Young Gates. She married a man named Thomas Williams when she was 18 years old in 1868. Thomas already had a wife, but they met when she was performing in the Salt Lake Theater, and apparently Thomas was involved with the Salt Lake Theater as well. Zinah became part of the LDS Retrenchment Society, and she later became very active in the suffrage movement. And she was involved in learning Sarah culture. Thomas Williams died 7 years after she married him, and then she married her second husband, Charles Ora Card, who was also a polygamist. They moved to Canada and established the town of Cardston. And there, Zinah became a midwife, and she cared for all of the people of the town and earned the name and the title of Aunt Zinah. And so she was called Aunt Zinah, both in Canada and later after she moved back to Salt Lake City. When she passed away, she was very well known. She's still well known today, and we know all about her. Now, I wanted to flip to a different app here, and I'm going to have my AV assistant help me with this. So, in fact, Zinah Presendia Young Williams Card was so famous, she has a page in the first 50 years of Relief Society. And we know all about her life. She appears in Women of Conviction on the church's website. I'm just showing you how much detail we have about her. So one thing that was interesting about Zinah can find it. You see here in this paragraph, Zina, when she met her husband Thomas, it says, all it says was that he already had a wife. That's all we know about that first wife. I discovered that that first wife was Anne Eckford Williams, who made these cross stitches. And in fact, so my friend's family decided that they wanted to sell this embroidery, and Reed Moon of Reed Moon's Rare Books purchased it from the family, had it properly framed to preserve it, and he has it here today. Reed, will you bring that forward? And I invite you to come and look at it afterwards. It's no, it's on permanent display at Moon's Rare Books in Provo if you'd like to go see it. This is the only photo I was able to find of Anne Eckford Williams. And indeed, if it weren't for these embroideries that she made, this artifact, we would know nothing about her. Like her embroidery, whose colors faded over time, her life fades from the public record after this, even though the sister wife that came along just a few years later is so well known. We know nothing about Anne except for these embroideries. I look forward to continuing my research. The trail kind of ended there, but I'd like to continue to try and find out more about Anne and find out what happened to her after her husband took his second wife, Zina. I think that we can learn from this research, we can learn about what is it that makes some women famous and their legacies last while others fade. Was Zina famous? Did she remain in Mormon memory because of her privileged background, her parents, because of her literacy and all she was able to write? Was it because of her activism in the suffrage movement? Was it because she was the second wife? Was it because she later became the wife of a famous man? Anne, we know so little about, but because of artifact, we can remember and uncover the hidden history of many women. Thank you.
Keith A. Erickson is the director of the Church History Library. He received a doctoral degree in history from Indiana University and earned a Master of Business Administration degree from the University of Texas at El Paso, where he was also an associate professor of history. He is the author of numerous books and articles. Now he's going to get us all shook up today with his presentation, Ain't Nothing But a Forgery, Elvis's Book of Mormon, and 20th Century Latter-day Saint Pop Culture.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here and to say a few words about a book in the collection in the Church History Library. The book was published in the 1970s, and it was acquired by the church in 1989. There are, on the pages of the book, 89 of the book's pages have handwritten annotations. Most of these are underlines, circles, check marks, but on 36 of the pages, there is a text, written text. On the very first page is a signature, E.A. Presley, which is the way that Elvis Presley signed contracts and checks. It's not the way he signed autographs for fans, but it is the way he signed official documents. And on the very last page, it has this inscription, Father, I want more. I need more now. Help me. And so for about 30 years, this book has been in the collection, and many people have cherished the book and the stories and the idea that Elvis Presley read the book, wrote in the book, and had these kind of interactions with the church. The long story short is that we've analyzed the handwriting, and it is not the handwriting of Elvis Presley. I prepared a summary of this analysis to be published in the Church News, and when I sent it in, it had this headline: Elvis did not write in this book. Now, headline writers didn't like that at all, and so they wrote their own headline, which is this one. Elvis's copy of the Book of Mormon ain't nothing but a forgery. So that's kind of stuck with it. So those findings were published last fall, and since then I've been asked several questions, and three of them I want to share here and elaborate on. One of them is the question, are you sure? And there's almost a pleading behind it. Say it ain't so. I really wanted this story to be true. Second question is, who would do this and why? And then the third question is the one that's most relevant to this session is, will you keep it? And I think the subtext here is, if the document isn't what it purports to be, then what is its historical value, and will you keep it in the collection? So the first question, are you sure? I won't go through all of the analysis, but you can read it in BYU Studies. We looked through the context of its creation, the provenance. There were multiple stories about where the book came from and what happened. The signature turns out to be quite different, and the handwriting, in the words of one of the analysts, was not even close. So we sent the text out to five handwriting Elvis handwriting analysts or music industry analysts, but I'll share a few with you. So here is an authentic signature from Elvis Presley on one of the checks that he signed. Here is the signature that's in the book in the Church History Library collection. So there are a few things that the forger got right. As you try and interpret, get into the mind, who did this and why would they do this, some things they got right. The EA was not the typical fan signature. The way the A is written, it's kind of a larger lowercase a, not like a capital A, and the P being prominent. The analysts came back with a couple of, but on every single letter, and the article goes through letter by letter, there are problems. But the biggest problems are the capital P that's connected to Presley, and then the S being closed, going all the way back to Elvis's fifth grade signature on a book in his school library. He didn't close the bottom of the S in Presley. And so that was one. And then the end, the E and the Y at the end, there's definitely something funky going on there. And then here's some authentic, and Elvis was a reader. He read a lot. He was someone who annotated books and left writing in the text. You'll see here his handwriting is block letters, kind of all caps. And what we have in the text in the Church History Library is what the analyst said. This is not even close. We've got the smooth, flowing, cursive letters. That's the one I read earlier. Here's the one that's probably gotten the most attention. It says, my Lisa, his daughter, needs this church. She's only 9. Help her for me. This is written in the passage near the end of the Book of Mormon that talks about infant baptism. And so that's where this inscription is written. And then there are little ones throughout. So there's an underline, they were desirous to be baptized, and then the forger wrote, me too, in the margin next to the text. So the sensible conclusion, the evidence points toward forgery. When you do document authentication, you can never say 100% that something was forged, unless we get a confession or something like that. And there are still some questions that I can't answer, that people who really want this story to be true, I can't answer some of these scenarios. I can only say that all of the best evidence and the best analysis of the evidence points toward it being a forgery. So, in addition to writing in a scholarly journal, my 10-year-old daughter and I also tried to share these findings in the Bountiful Chalk Art Festival. And so there's our version of the story. And it was the only piece of chalk art with a footnote, with a citation to Brigham Young University studies. So the question that so many people ask, who would do this? The short answer to this one is, I don't know. There's not enough evidence to come to a conclusion. The person who donated the book is a woman named Cricket Coulter. And so she was born in Ohio, 1948. By fifth grade, she was a huge Elvis fan. She founded her first fan club. She followed Elvis around the country. She lived near him in California, Tennessee, Nevada. She attended 533 of his concerts. She appeared in a documentary that they did in 1970, That's the Way It Is. And she said there, when I think of most of the fans, they're the little teeny bopper kids that go, ah, and jump all over Elvis and stuff like that. I think I'm too mature for that. I'm more of a quiet fan. So Cricket was baptized into the church in Memphis in the summer of 1976. So those who wonder who did this, the suspicious minds point to Cricket, the donor, for a variety of reasons. She knew a lot about Elvis. She knew a lot about the church, or enough about the church, to find the passages and write the things that are there. She did leave an inscription inside the front cover of the book when she gives the book to Elvis. And this is one of her stories, that she wrote the inscription, she gave it to him. There are significant differences. This was one we also gave to the handwriting analysis. And they basically came away with, there wasn't enough to say. There are some words that she writes and that the supposed Elvis writes, Cricket and Presley, and those words appear different. Those are also words that somebody would say, well, if you're trying to forge it and make it look different, then you would make Presley look different when you wrote it to your friend Elvis Presley, and then when the forged version is there. So the best conclusion we can come to right now is that the forger is unknown. Cricket is still alive. She's not in very good health. I did take these findings to her. She was initially she expressed surprise, but then she stuck to one of her stories, which was that she gave the book to Elvis, and that when it came back, those inscriptions were there. And so that's where we are now. I don't know who did that. So the question is of, will you keep it? And I've been asked this so many times. Well, if it isn't authentic, if it isn't Elvis, why would you keep it? And the answer there, and I think is really relevant for this session, is a resounding yes, because it tells us so much more, not necessarily about Elvis, but about Latter-day Saints, and particularly Latter-day Saints in the late 20th century. So I'm going to use a little bit of math that comes from one of those expose books of con artists. This is one of the kinds of reading I got to do in this project. And so this was a guy, he was a con man in the British context. He's since come clean and now does some reality shows on TV where they'll con people and you see it happen and then to try and teach you how to avoid it. But he said it's simple, and it is so simple you can reduce it to a mathematical equation. X plus Y equals Z. When X is a fact, and Y is any lie that you want that relates to the fact, so long as that leads to the thing that your target desires the most, then it works every time. So the example he gives in the text in his book is that if you have a person who really wants to lose weight, then tell them, yeah, have a healthy diet, plus this unproven dietary supplement that I'll sell you for $49.99, and that will give you guaranteed easy results, because that's what the person really wants. They don't want to exercise. They don't want to change their lifestyle. That desire will lead them to accept any lie that you want to give them. So If we do a little bit of algebra and work this around, if I've got a fact that there was a Book of Mormon that was published, and there are lies written into the book, what is it? What is the great desire that that Latter-day Saints have that makes this such a compelling story? And for 30 years, this was a story told by speakers, by teachers, by journalists, by fireside speakers. This was just a story that the Latter-day Saints loved to tell, they loved to hear. It was the subject of an independent film. It aired once. After that, Elvis Presley Enterprises came in with the copyright infringement lawsuit and shut it down. So if you didn't see it that one time in 2007, you'll probably never see it again. One of the interesting things about this story is that it was accepted into our collective storytelling with very little analysis. Even the journalists who are known to be tough on stories and just let it slide, they let it go. Our own staff in the library would show the book and just say, well, this is what people told us, and so that's what we'll do. The filmmaker kept saying he was going to have it authenticated, but then time ran out and he made the film and never got around to authenticating it. But he sort of knew that you didn't need to authenticate it because he just knew it. So I've reviewed the material, I've talked to lots of people. If I could summarize it into three things, what's the desire behind this story? One of them is this story of individual change and redemption. And this is the story that's written in the book. The passages that are marked are places where someone like King Noah is a wine bibber, and so the forged Elvis expresses sadness that somebody would drink and behave like that. And then the forged Elvis writes later, me too, that I want to be baptized. And so the annotations in the story clearly tell this story. The forger thought that that was a story that we would like. There's also a story of collective redemption here. This one shows up most often in the stories told in the music industry. This is a big story for musicians. They would talk about it in firesides and sometimes in other more public settings. And basically the version is, if Elvis is okay with us, then there's a place for us in the music industry. And that's kind of Elvis gives us the legitimacy. If he's okay, then we're okay. And then thirdly, there was just kind of a sense of this being an inspiring story. It's one of those faith-promoting stories. It just made you feel good. It made you feel so good. It had to be true and good. So the painting on the screen is the only painting that Elvis ever commissioned of himself. It's life-size, and it hangs at Graceland. And so this is the way Elvis saw himself. And I think this is the way Latter-day Saints might imagine Elvis in his temple white, and the clouds. So there was just a convergence here that the story really did tap into what the saints desired. So for spending time with me, for listening to the stories, all I can say to you today is thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, I think we should give our presenters one more round of applause here. All right, and we are now going to hear some comments on today's presentations by Alan L. Morrell. He's a curator of artifacts in Latter-day Saint history at the Church History Museum, and he received a doctoral degree in history from the University of Utah. Alan.
I'm honored that I was asked to comment on the papers of these four movers and shakers in Mormon history. It's made me think a lot about the role of commentators for a conference panel. There's a performative nature to what we're doing, and so far everybody's just done what they're supposed to. The audience didn't come up and try to take these seats. They already knew what they were supposed to do. The presenters knew what was expected. And we all, if we've been to conferences, know what commentators do. They summarize what was just said. They say two or three nice things. They say one critical thing and then ask some questions. And I wondered, is that what I'm supposed to do? The American Historical Association reprinted some articles from the Chronicle of Higher Education by Linda Kerber entitled Conference Rules. Number 3, everything you need to know about your role as a commentator or member of the audience. That's most of us in this room. Number 1, direct criticism. Number 2, there's the direct compliment. But she said, quote, but often the most useful way for you to spend your allotted time is to devote relatively little of it to complaints or compliments about individual papers. Instead, try to embed such remarks into a wider ranging reflections. So I want to reflect on the things that I learned from these papers. Initially, when I was asked to come and present, I thought, yeah, I'll celebrate that we have some scholars here doing material culture. And then I would say, when you come to Salt Lake City, don't stop at just the Church History Library. Come over to the museum, look at some artifacts, and bring those into the sources that you use. But there's 3 quick dates from significant publications that I think really challenge this view of Mormon scholars have not used material culture. Number 1, publication of the Winterthur Portfolio happened in 1964. If you're good at math, that was 55 years ago. 13 years later, James Dietz published in Small Things Forgotten, The Archaeology of Early American Life. In 1982, we have Jules Prown's Mind and Matter, An Introduction to Material Culture Theory and Method. And I wondered, have Mormon scholars been blind to these developments? Of course not. A couple of Mormon historian luminaries were critical in this broader movement. We have Richard Bushman's The Refinement of America, Persons, Houses, Cities in 1993. Or Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's The Age of Homespun, Objects and Stories in the Creation of an American Myth, 2001. We note in their writing of Latter-day Saint history an appreciation and use of non-traditional sources, including artifacts. So what about the use of non-traditional sources amongst the rest of us? Are we using them? The fact is it's plentiful. From scholarship on headstones to Mormon hay derricks to city blocks and wide streets to naming conventions to polygamous housing to temple architecture, the many uses of oils and ritual in Mormon rituals, pine furniture, or the decaying corpse. I could go on and on. I soon realized that I was setting up a straw man to celebrate these great papers. In fact, I noticed in some panels I attended yesterday a close examination of the monument to the Women Memorial Garden in Nauvoo, Illinois, an analysis of the Ezra Taft Benson's family appearance on the Edward R. Murrow Show. Another panel looked at voice and Mormon musicals, and 2 demonstrated a close reading of art rather than just using art as illustration. Having said all this, I think we can still celebrate the continued incorporation of non-traditional sources as highlighted here. I'd like to focus on this panel's use of the word artifact. I went ahead and read the topics of the 4 papers and noticed that one was about a book and the other a document, and it took me back to my Sesame Street days as a kid. One of these things is not like the other. And I wondered, does that apply to the artifacts? If you were to look at this, what of those 3 do not belong in this grouping? And I think coming from a museum, I look at it and say, well, one's a museum item and the other 3 you'll find in the library. But maybe this helps us re-examine that cultural assumption. Which of these 1 does not belong? And our cultural understanding might pick one out, but further exploration, is it the man versus the 3 women? Is it the white woman? Is it the older woman? Which of these three don't belong? And how did we come up with these boundaries in which we have understanding? The answer is it's the one with glasses. So one of the important things, and Laura Ulrich really highlighted this, is she looked at Harvard's several collections. We have these artificial boundaries, and they need to be challenged. And I think that's what's happened with this presentation, is that we need to have more of an anthropological approach to what an artifact is. Anything created by man that has meaning. So let me highlight just some of the things that I just really love from these great papers. First of all, that they grabbed four artifacts and just dug into them. And this is one of the things that any of us can do. Find an artifact, look at it, and start asking questions and start answering questions. And it almost acts as a portal to the past in which you're able to uncover all sorts of incredible things through that tangible artifact. Elise Boxer's paper on indigenous cradleboards is a wonderful example of why historians need to move beyond the traditional historical sources often housed in archives and libraries. Gina Colvin's observation of the, quote, ongoing colonization of indigenous people vis-a-vis the Mormon archive is haunting, and it's given me a lot to think about. The uses or lack thereof of cradle boards and the evolution of those physical objects are powerful historical sources. You know, you can look at the evolution, and I can't wait to see more research done on the cradle board and how it changed with time and the meaning attached to it. Now, the only way that you can pull information out of these physical artifacts is if you have the skills that make it possible to read them. The cradle board cannot be understood in isolation. You need a deep understanding of the culture, including language skills, understanding of naming conventions, the worldviews of those who make and use those artifacts, for them to really speak to you. And I thought it was interesting how both Elise's and Ian's presentations, language is so critical to the understanding, and you need to have that ability and skill to really have those things communicate. These insights and perspectives cannot be uncovered using traditional methods and sources, but that doesn't mean that traditional sources are useless. The several artifacts that have made it through time and are at our disposal must converse with each other in our attempts to uncover the past. And she emphasized that in her presentation, that you need to learn to read between the lines in order to get some of the information out of traditional sources. Ian Barber's paper, A Strange and Interesting Document, The Latter-day Saints' Shaping of a Prophetic Maori Covenant, demonstrates how cultural blinders affect the way we read and understand a document. It is wonderful to have someone with Ian's training and background to remind us that written documents are artifacts. How documents are received and understood is intimately tied to time and place. Ian also demonstrates how culture impacts the process of translation. Matthew Cowley's religious knowledge and experiences impacted the way he understood the words on the page. He couldn't help but see parallels and fulfillment of prophecy. Ian's use of the Mormon missionary Alma Greenwood's 1883 words reinforced Elise's observation about using outsider accounts. There is power in uses for all sources. We just need to be careful and close examination of a single document and its varied uses and understanding over time. The document, the primary source, is front and center, questioned, re-examined, retranslated, reinterpreted. Ian reminds us that we need to question all that we know or think we know about the artifacts lying before us. We need to try and wipe our minds clean of all we know and see things through new eyes. So I really enjoyed also Barbara's presentation on Anne Eckford. And how it was interesting, you needed another artifact, a second artifact, the Nauvoo temple plate, to understand the cross stitch, and that you can find these clues all over the place. Barbara, I wish that every historian would do what you do, and I don't know how we work this into graduate school or into an undergraduate program. In order to graduate, you've got to grab an artifact and research it. And then I thought a little bit, and I'll talk to Keith, but about the evidence that is inherent in the artifact. In Keith's example, it was the penmanship, it was the writing, but I thought about the stitches and how they're evidence of the creator. It's almost as though it's its own signature. And as demonstrated, artifact research is an awful lot like detective work, and I think that's much of the fun. Finally, Keith Erickson's paper. Thank you. My whole world just came crashing down. Is nothing sacred at the Church History Library? Like Ian's paper, Keith demonstrates how critical it is that we question and take nothing at face value. Keith's paper made me think about the role of trust and caution in the historical endeavor. How carefully I have questioned the sources that I and other historians have used in creating our narratives of the past. Yet we all know, if we've done any research, limitations of time and finances force us at some level to trust others. But how grateful I am when scholars like Keith and Ian say, wait a minute, let's take a closer look at this. How strong is the provenance? What was Elvis doing during those 2 weeks that he purportedly read and commented on this book? What do experts say about the evidence left in this document? Keith's paper also reminded me of something that a professor at Villanova would tell us. We see through a glass darkly. The past is lost to us. We do our best to put together a story about it from the bits and pieces that have survived. I would love to know the whole story of whoever marked up that Book of Mormon and why. Sure, not as much as you, but I might never know. But Keith, you've convinced me that it wasn't Elvis. So, Tiffany, I've got some questions that we can fall back on, but I think it's more important that everybody else has a chance to ask some questions. So, thank you.